Well, I was quite pleased when I read the book. I did enjoy it very much. I also liked the primitive artwork on the cover, which is very, very nice.
It's a beautiful jacket, isn't it?
Tell me
a little bit about yourself. The biographical data here makes up one sentence, so I don't know of anything about you. I know you are from Georgia?
No, I'm from Alabama. I was born in Monroeville, Alabama, which is the same hometown that Harper Lee was from, To Kill a Mockingbird. You know that town? It's the same town. And Truman Capote spent his summers there, wrote A Christmas Memory about the town. I was born there. We moved all over the place. Lived in the Midwest when I was growing up. And finally went back to the University of Alabama to school. And then I went to work for the Birmingham News as a journalist. And then for Southern Living Magazine, which is everybody's favorite magazine if you're a mother in the South. And then from there to the Journal and Constitution in Atlanta, which is where I am now. I'm the regional editor of the newspaper.
Now, you grew up predominantly where?
In the Midwest.
Whereabouts in the Midwest?
Ohio and Indiana.
Where in Ohio?
Dayton. Mm-hmm. And Muncie, Indiana, mainly. My father was a salesman for Ralston Purina, and they're kind of like the Air Force. They move you every 2 years, so I was kind of a Purina brat.
Yeah. Well, what do you consider most predominant of all of your roots, which seem to be somewhat varied?
It would have to be Alabama. Greenville specifically, which is a little town south of Montgomery. My grandmother always lived there, and we always came back there in the summers and for Christmas. So all that moving around and everything, we always considered that Alabama was home.
So you went to the University of Alabama.
Right.
What was your major?
I studied journalism and English with a minor in creative writing, so I was fairly narrow there. I studied under Barry Hanna, fiction writing, and Tom Rabbit, who's a poet. And I'm not a poet, but he taught me a few things about it.
I'm not so sure about that. I guess you knew pretty early on about what you wanted to do then. Did you declare a major right off when you went to college?
Yeah. When you come from Monroeville, Alabama, which is where Harper Lee was from, I guess it's kind of like coming from Herschel Walker's hometown. You want to grow up to be a running back. Well, in Monroeville, you kind of want, you know, the local hero was a writer. And so from very early on, I was intrigued by that book. It was the first grown-up book I ever read. And to look around and see the real town around me, and then to read how it was transformed into fiction, I just decided that that was something I'd like to try. And then in high school, I entered a short story contest and won, and I said, well, this is something I might can do. So, I did decide early.
That's a small town. Did you ever have a chance to meet her?
No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I've just heard that she read about my book somewhere, and she's called an aunt who called an aunt who called an aunt and says she'd like to meet me. It's been a lifelong ambition of mine to meet her because she's a recluse, you know, and she's also a hero of mine. She lives mostly in New York.
It's the only book she ever wrote.
Right.
Which is
apparently she's written a couple of others but has never let anyone see them. Mm-hmm. Because she felt they didn't measure up.
When did you graduate from college?
1978.
And you went
Straight to the Birmingham News.
How long were you there?
I was there for 2 years, then 4 years at Southern Living, and then joined the Journal Constitution.
Where is Southern Living?
Southern Living's based in Birmingham, but it's a 2 million circulation magazine that goes all over the South. It's kind of like Sunset on the West Coast. Southern Living is a home, garden, food, travel, and features. And
What did you do?
I was the features editor. I wrote a column called Southerners. We did people of note around the South. I did special features. One time we did a 10-month project where we went from Maryland to Mexico all the way around the coast interviewing fishermen and commercial fishermen going out on their shrimp boats and shooting pictures of them. And so I got to see the South. You know, we covered 18 states and it was all on an expense account. So I kind of got a wonderful tour of the South.
Are you currently with the Constitution?
Right.
Journal Constitution.
Journal and Constitution. Mm-hmm. They've merged the papers there.
You're a regional editor.
Right.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, we have 6 reporters stationed around the South, and I'm more or less in charge of. There's a slogan at the Constitution that's been there for years. It covers Dixie like the dew. So I guess I'm responsible for covering Dixie like the dew.
Your more pragmatic journalistic responsibilities. Does that clash at all with the literary thrust of your new novel?
I think it feeds it, actually. In one sense, work begets work. If you're working hard during the day, I tend to work hard at night. And also there's something about, you know, a novel takes 10 months to make from the moment that you turn it into the publisher. A newspaper story, you put it in and you see it in your hands in 45 minutes, so I can get instant gratification during the day and then go home and work on longer range things at night. So I've never really found a conflict except maybe time.
Is that what you did? You worked during the day and then went home and wrote?
Right. And when I worked for the magazine, I was on the road a lot, 2 weeks out of the month usually. And I carried my typewriter with me and worked in Holiday Inns all over America. I found that, you know, some writers feel like they have to have one place to write. Well, a Holiday Inn room is the same anywhere you go.
No,
it's kind of like a portable office.
Do you have a family?
No. I guess that's one thing that working two full-time jobs does, is cuts down on your social life a little bit.
So when did you start A World Is Made of Fire? A World Made of Fire?
4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 4 years before I turned it in, so in 1979.
Tell me a little bit about the origins, the genesis of the book.
I started with a setting and a couple of characters. The setting is roughly my grandmother's place outside of Greenville, Alabama. It's an old house that sits up on a hill, or did. It happened to burn down last Christmas after I had turned this novel in.
What an odd coincidence.
It certainly was. My mother told me to please watch what I write from now on. But I started with that, and my grandmother had a brother who had polio when he was a child. So I started with the idea of what would their childhoods have been like. And I started with page one when he was born. And, of course, it's changed since then, but I just sort of started making it up as I went along. So nothing in it is true except the sort of the sense of the two characters and their ages and the place that it takes place in.
Well, did you sit down and just start writing with this idea in the back of your mind, or did you pretty well plot the novel?
No, I really made it up as I went along.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's an unusual way of working, I guess. I can't see how someone can sit down and outline a novel, how they could then be interested in sitting down to write it every night. To me, part of the joy is finding out what's going to happen next. I guess the reader, too. Of course, it required me to write 8 drafts of it to make it all make sense, you know, by the time it was over.
Well, the novel is elusive in some respects because there are so many mystical elements about it. Did you intend this to be a horror novel?
No, not at all. I've seen it called a horror novel and a Southern Gothic novel.
I hesitated to use the term horror because I don't think it is as such, and I don't think it's Southern Gothic
no.
either.
But everybody always seeks to fit something into a slot, you know. I guess I was working with some of the conventions of a Southern Gothic story. But, you know, Flannery O'Connor had a wonderful thing to say about that. She said that anything that comes out of the South is regarded as grotesque, unless it's really grotesque, in which case it's regarded as realistic. And there's some truth to that. You know, some of the people at the publisher here were surprised at the primitivism of the people, the fact that they didn't really know that World War I was going on, or that they didn't have lights in 1906. And I said, well, come on down to Butler County, Alabama, and we'll go off the main road, and there are places that's still like that. So I guess to me it was a blend of the Southern Gothic, as it's called, you know, in the sense that Flannery O'Connor used it, and some of the South American novelists are intrigued by the idea that reality and fantasy can be mixed. So I'd say the biggest influence on me is Marquez,
Marquez.
And 100 Years of Solitude, and the idea that of that seamless line between reality and fantasy, and you can't tell where it goes. So that's kind of what I was trying to do.
Well, the fact that Stephen King did a review, of course, it may help to lump you with the Stephen King, the Peter Straub element. Not that that's bad necessarily.
That's true.
Especially with regard to Peter Straub, who is actually a very fine writer.
Yeah, someone said that, aren't you afraid of being typecast? And I said, well, I wouldn't be afraid of being typecast as a successful writer like Stephen King, but I think the only way, you know, you only have one novel out. The only way you're going to escape typecasting is with your second novel, and my second one is going to be so different from the first that I think, you know, I just have to sort of write my way out of this slot.
Well, I certainly like the way you did it. One thing I was confused about, and maybe it's just because I read it too fast, I don't know, but I lost William somewhere at the end. As I recall, he was with the group of blacks, and they opened the door. There was a ball of fire outside, and I don't think William reappeared, did he?
He's on his knees in the tent as it's burning, yeah. And he's shouting up. And Gibson goes in to rescue him, and the tent falls in on both of them. It's in there, I promise you.
All right. Your word, I'll take.
Okay.
You're working on a new novel.
Yes.
And you say it's radically different from this.
I think so. I'm only 150 pages into it, so I don't really know quite what it's going to be yet. Once again, I'm making it up as I go along.
Set in the South?
It's set in Mobile Bay, which is further south in Alabama, but they get in a boat and they take off, and I don't know where they're going. So it's not going to be as strictly a Southern novel as this is. Mobile Bay is very much a sort of almost a New Orleans, a mix of the Caribbean and the European and Creole and some South American cultures all around this one little bay. And so to me, this is what you could call a Deep South novel. I mean, there's no doubt that World Made of Fire is set where it is and that the people in it are hardcore white and black Southerners. I'm hoping that the second one's going to be a bigger, more ambitious, hopefully a funnier book, and just a different tone. I'm trying for a different
tone. Is it still? Are you still going to make use of this poetic approach?
The cadence is not so strictly. No, that was something I did in an effort to evoke the time, which was 1909 in this particular case. And the book I'm writing now starts in 1944, so it calls for a whole different language, a whole different tone and feeling, and I think it will probably come close up to the present. So while I'm fascinated by the idea of rhythms and how you can move a story or not move a story, depending on how you work the rhythms of the sentences, I don't think it's going to be so much a heavily poetically structured book as this one is. I used Rhapsody in Blue as the structure of this book. I had to learn something about structure. You know, you never know how to write a novel until you write one. That's the only way I knew to figure it out. And I was also learning to play Rhapsody in Blue on the piano. So I'd go in every night, and if you go back and read the book knowing that, you might detect that there's a clarinet run in the first chapter, and that it builds and rests and all that sort of thing, very similarly to the way he did it.
What has been the reaction of your colleagues and your friends in Atlanta to the book?
They're very excited about it. It's an interesting time in Atlanta because there are a lot of writers popping out with books now, and a lot of first novelists. Now, I've only been there for about 10 months, so it's not really so much my Atlanta friends who are impressed and amazed or whatever as it is the people back in Alabama, who are all just beside themselves, as you can imagine.
Have you run into Terry Kay?
Yes, he's a good friend of mine. And Dark 30 is a wonderful book.
It's wonderful.
Really?
I couldn't, he wasn't going to be in New York, but I liked the book so much that I called him. And it's awkward to do an interview like we're doing on the telephone because there's so much groping, especially I don't know you, and I didn't know Terry either, and so many things, background that I have to know, and so it was a little difficult, but I phoned him and I did an interview with Terry on the phone, and
that's terrific.
I think it worked out all right. I think it sounded pretty good.
He's a writer who has yet to do, I mean, he's done some fabulous work, but he's got his best work in front of him. That's what's exciting about knowing Terry, is that with every book he's much better than the one before. I'd love to be that kind of a writer, you know, who makes his readers expect, what are you going to do next?
Well, I will certainly. Well, you have already. I mean, I will certainly look for your next book. I mean, I will remember the name, and I will. I mean, I would buy it on the name alone.
That's terrific.
You mentioned about the lights. Some people not having lights. I think Terry wrote a book called After Eli,
Haven't read it.
That was set in 1948, and that was about the year the lights first went on in this rural area of Georgia.
Well, there are still
when he was a kid. He was 11 years old.
Right. And the rural electrification.
When they first had electricity, and he was 11.
And telephones. My grandmother didn't have a telephone until 1966, and that was quite something. I mean, that was really considered a grand luxury. Of course, it was a party line, and I loved that. You know, get to pick up the phone and listen to everybody else. But
outside of yourself and Terry Kay, is there any kind of literary establishment in Atlanta?
Yeah, Pat Conroy is working and writing there.
He wrote Conrack, didn't he?
Right, and Great Santini and Lords of Discipline, and he's got a new novel that'll be out next year, I believe. Olivan Burns has a new book out called Cold Sassy Tree. It's her first novel, and it's been a big success. I'm trying to remember. I think Houghton Mifflin did it. It's 35,000 first printing for a first novel, which is kind of astounding. Who else is working there? A lot of interesting people.
I know James Dickey's no longer there, but
he pops in and out.
Yeah. Well, I just talked to him 2 weeks ago, and I edited the interview I did with him yesterday, and I have it all set.
He's a good interview, isn't he?
Well, he's very colorful. He comes in with the big hat, and he married one of his students after his wife died.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he's very colorful.
He's got a little girl.
Yeah. And,
she's great.
I saw the photographs. He's been up a couple of times, and we try to chat. I try to do poetry and poets when I can, if they're not too elusive. I think sometimes poetry gets a raw deal, and it's not widely accepted. Sometimes, in a way, you can spring poetry on people in the way you've done without letting them know it's poetry.
I had never thought of it in those terms, but I think that's true.
You do poetry at all?
No, I'm terrible at it. I mean, I have a problem reading most modern poetry because I think a lot of it is designed to be inaccessible. And then when I go back and read old poets that I think are great, like Whitman, like Emily Dickinson, I have no trouble understanding what it is that they're trying to say. And then if I go back and read it again, I see something else they were trying to say. It seems to me a lot of poets today are writing for each other or themselves or to be misunderstood. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's kind of like abstract art, you know. We want to do a painting that's not a painting of anything, right?
It's a valid criticism, especially among those who rank very high in the literary establishment. I think they do write for themselves. Robert Lowell was like that. And his stuff was so autobiographical that you have to know almost every detail of his life to understand what he's saying.
You just wish he'd have write a little journal along with it so you could know what he's talking about.
But you can read between the lines. You can. Lowell, for example, was a man obviously clearly in anguish through his. He was certifiably insane, and didn't know how to deal with these manic fits of depression. And so you can read his poetry, and although you may not understand everything he's saying, you can see that there is somebody in trouble who's shouting or calling out somehow. And it's interesting, but we know this more in retrospect.
Right.
Because there have been a lot of biographies. On my shelf, I have most of Lowell's stuff, and poetry is very thin. It stretches about a foot and a half.
Of course, that's a lot of books in a foot and a half.
Live in Manhattan in a Manhattan apartment, you count your books by the foot.
That's right.
So I have about a foot and a half of Robert Lowell and about 3 feet of books about Lowell. So they're almost a cottage industry.
But you know, it's funny, if you go back and look at Emily Dickinson, a biography of her diminishes the poetry. It doesn't expand on it. It's kind of like to know something about her life almost reduces the poetry or the importance of it. So I don't know where we've gone with that. The poet becomes more important than the poetry? Something.
What do you like to read? What have been some of your literary influences?
I'm really turned on by the South Americans, Pablo Neruda, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Borges, Octavio Paz, Carlos Fuentes. There's just, to me, there's so many exciting things going on down there. Of course, I went through my Southern period, you know, which was Faulkner and most especially Flannery O'Connor. She's my patron saint. I'm liking a lot of the new fiction that's out. I just read Victory Over Japan by Ellen Gilchrist, which won the National Book Award. Or American Book Award, I guess it is these days. And it's a wonderful collection of stories. She's really good. And Barry Hannah, my old teacher, is one of my favorite stylists. He really has got a way of telling a lot of story in about two sentences.
Yeah, gosh, his books are so thin, though. I mean, 86 pages.
Not when he writes them. He sends them to Gordon Lish at Knopf, and Gordon makes them thin little books.
Was Gordon your editor?
No, Alice Quinn is my editor. You know, she's the edits the poetry series, too.
Mm-hmm. I can see Gordon Lish taking on a book like that. I've had Gordon in a few times. He's looking for voices.
Very much.
And doesn't care as much about the substance, but he does care about the way they sound and how they sound. He likes that, excites him very much. Did you read his Dear Mr. Capote?
I did. I think it's wonderful.
Really a bizarre, unusual.
And it explained a lot about Gordon Lish to me. About the kind of fiction that he's trying. I'd seen him speak a couple of times and never really quite got what he was getting at with all that talk about voice. And I guess the best way for anyone to do that is write a book and show folks what they mean.
All of his short stories, too, show the streak of madness. And he revealed quite directly on the air, on this microphone, that one of the reasons that he has this obsession with madness is that he himself was institutionalized in an insane asylum, twice.
Goodness. I don't know if I'd have told that.
No. Well, but it's really important when you think about it, because this will give you an even broader understanding of the way he thinks and how he approaches his own work and the mood, mm-hmm. the type of people he writes about, because they reflect his own visions of insanity. Mm-hmm. And he was extremely direct about that. And our whole broadcast dealt with... he's been up here a couple of times, but the last one, it was when we did Dear Mr. Capote, he didn't mention that. And I didn't know it, but I suspected it.
Yeah.
I didn't know it, but I felt that. But the second book, the collection of short stories, what I know so far, I don't know if you had a chance to read that.
Very no, I haven't.
Well, almost all of the people in there are all the stories are narrated, and almost all are narrated by people who are clearly insane.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to ask him, and he was extremely direct about it. I mean, I had to ask him about the origins for this interest and this obsession with madness, and he was very direct about it.
Well, Dear Mr. Capote is one of the few books I know that successfully brings off a madman hero. There's not very many of them. But, well, I'm thinking hero in classical terms. It's not that you want to go out and cheer for the fellow, but...
Yeah, it didn't quite seem as a hero.
Protagonist, perhaps, was the word I was seeking.
I just called him a narrator.
I think that's easier.
Well, Mark Childress, it was wonderful talking to you about literature and things you're interested in. I thought the world made a fire. I have to be careful about the title. I have a tendency to want to say is. A world is made of fire, because mm-hmm. I did Morris West a while
ago. A world is made of glass.
A world is made of glass, and... you know, so every time I read, I've been saying, a world is made of fire. And I said, not
my mother called me when she saw that Morris West's book was out, and she said, this man stole your title. I said, Mom, it doesn't work that way.
I have to be careful with the titles. I remember a few years ago, I was reading the New York Daily News used to have a book editor. They don't do books anymore. I think on Friday they do a little roundup of maybe two books.
Mm-hmm.
But they used to have a book editor there named Judson Hand, and when Sophie's Choice came out, did a long review of it, and the headline and all the references in the story were to Sophie's Way. And I still have the clipping, and I just thought, I mean, that's...
How can you read a whole book and get the title
that's
wrong?
That's really incredible. Well, you know, it's so easy to do.
Oh, of course it is.
Sometimes you look at it quickly, and you write your story and all of that, and you're
or
very
you,
careless.
You rename it in your own mind. You say, this book should be Sophie's Way.
Yeah, a World is Made of Fire.
I'll change it.
I've
the third edition. We'll do it.
Mark Childress, thank you very, very much. It was an impressive first effort, and congratulations on the book. And thanks again.
Thanks very much for having me.